Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week, highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first clip comes from WPEB 88.1, Scribe Radio, from the show Jubilee Voices. The kids hosts of the show are fourth graders from the Jubilee Elementary School. They interview the teacher, Mrs. Vern Oliver, about the
writer Richard Wright
and lynchings and migration of the black population from the Deep South of the United States.
Richard Wright was working for, he was down in Tennessee, I think, and he was working for a man. Now, if you were black, you couldn't go to a library. How dare you want to go to a library? Probably didn't read well enough, or even if you read well enough, there was no point in your coming to our library. But the man, the white guy for whom he worked, knew there was something special. See, people are good. Some are good. Knew there was something special about this boy's eagerness to read and to write. So he would get the books. Richard would read the books, and then he'd take him back to the library. And when he hit about 20 years old, he was asked by the librarian, why are you always coming here getting these books? You can't read, can you? Oh, no. I don't read. My boss. It was then he decided that he would leave. And it's a marvelous little book. I guess I like libraries because libraries have been a part of my life and certainly the life of all these people who came up eager to get an education. And Richard Wright wrote his, when he got here to New York, he, of course, wrote his book on Black Boy, which is an incredible book to read. But motivation, I have to get out of here because if I don't, I'm going to die, I can't read. And if they know that I can read, my life isn't worth 2 cents. So that's what he learned. But that's well, Langston, of course, always talked about his Indian background, too, but he was not born in New York. I can't think of, and Marion and Du Bois, I'm trying to think of who was. So it would be good to look to see who the Harlem Renaissance people were. The Mecca, that is a place they all were drawn to, was New York. And you also know who else was drawn to New York. Those who'd been in the war. See, they came from all the states. They were drafted into the army, right? And then they went over there. And over there, they got a kind of freedom. They saw other people. They didn't have to drink out of a fountain that said black, or they didn't say black, colored or white. They could go to the libraries. They could go to the bars. They could go to the restaurants. They could go to the theater. They could even be hired in the theater by, well, give me an example of who worked in the theater. Who sang? Pretty Little Brown Girl.
Ethel?
No, before Ethel. Ethel is a little different. This one wanted to sing, and it was a little saucy. And the French loved her, and she adopted several children. Does that make any sense? She had to go, according to her, to France. Because in the United States, if you were as brown as she was, they weren't interested in anything. And the French loved her. Josephine. You know Josephine Baker? The main reason why you had this flood of people within our nation coming to New York or coming north, not just to New York, but Chicago, Detroit. They didn't go to California. California is a different thing. These were people, for the most part, who were second generation removed from slavery. There were no jobs. They had very little education. And immediately after they were emancipated, or their families were freed, there developed groups in the South that didn't like them and who were determined to make their lives miserable. Lynchings, opportunities to frighten them. The few little schools that were established were one room. Even a teacher who probably didn't have more than fourth grade education. If you read the story of the present black member of the Supreme Court, get some idea of what was going on. The other thing is there was an excitement in the air all over because the soldiers were coming back. The men, for the most part, were slipping here and there to the west and to the north, leaving their families or sending little money back. But New York was supposed to be our Paris. Art, music, you can get a job, you can make it, you can survive. And you had some families that had dribbled up that you could visit. For example, when we bought our house had a small sunroom, a living room, a bedroom, kitchen, and then upstairs, my mother's and father's bedroom. My sister and I had one bedroom, you know, had the room, a small room for my brother, and another. So there were four bedrooms upstairs. But when everybody started coming north, my mother, who had more resources than most, added an apartment at one time, and then a second apartment. And that's where my Aunt Bessie and her husband lived. My sister and I were sometimes pushed out of the bed when somebody came, and we had to come down and sleep on the living room couch. So part of it was because those who were not afraid had come in small groups. That helped. As you see, 11 in one family, and they all came here to this area. And I think part of it was also the lives that they led. You couldn't go to the stores. First time I was 23 when I went south, and I went to teach in Richmond. And I got on the bus, and everything got so quiet. I didn't realize that that was a faux pas. I shouldn't have done that. So I wasn't going to be Rosa Parks, so I got off. And then when I was in Washington, I was a graduate student, and I went to the 5 and 10 to buy all my notebooks and pens and all the stuff. And I was hungry, so I went to I plopped up on the hot dog counter in a 5 and 10. And she said, "Oh, you can't sit there. You can stand at the court. You can stand at the end of the counter." And I said stupidly, "For a hot dog? You mean I can't get a hot dog? I can't sit at this dinky..." But then I said, "Get out of here. Forget it." So the prejudices they felt in the South, well, you know about the young men who went and sat at counters and how they were able to play a major part. Well, as a single person, it was, but these were people who had those things every day. Every day. You couldn't go to a grocery store and you stand back and wait until everybody gets that place. And then last thing, when I was at Morgan, I went to an elegant hat store, elegant department store. And as I did, you know, your request, I went and I said, "Oh, maybe I'll buy a beautiful hat." And I was trying on a hat. "Oh, miss, you have to put on a stocking cap." So I said, "You may have your hat," and I walked out. So those little things, here I am, I'm still remembering it. Those little slights that you have. So New York, or anything north of Philadelphia. You see, because the Mason-Dixon line is, above Maryland. Maryland was a heavily slave state. And Washington was also, I should say Washington, a lot of the people, immigrants. Now, do you know the difference between migration, immigration, and emigration? You can guess. Migration means what?
Migration means to move from one place to another.
You got to qualify it. In the same country?
Yes.
Yes.
And immigration is where you're in one place, like, say, well, my dad's from New Zealand, so he moved.
No, from where?
From New Zealand.
So
he moved from New Zealand to America, and that's immigration.
Yes, but if he has family back there in New Zealand, New Zealand would call him what? He wouldn't call him an immigrant. An immigrant is a person who goes into. It's immigrant. And then you'll come across it in the history with the French. To immigrate is to leave the United States. To come into the United States, you're an immigrant, right? And a migrant is you're moving. That's good. Got good heads.
We know you met some people from the Harlem Renaissance. Who did you meet?
Well, the people from, I met two or three times and had the best connection to was Langston. I had seen him at several conferences. He was a very good friend of a man called Harold Jackman. Harold Jackman was my daughter's godfather. And Harold collected a lot of black materials and placed them at Atlanta University. In fact, when my husband died, that's why I don't have any books now. He was a professor of history, a professor of literature. But when he died, I sent the best books to Atlanta to become part of the collection down there. And then the rest I gave to the Fortune Society, which is a society that works with men who have been in prison who come out. Then the other connection I had with him, well, I liked him. He was not a very tall person. He was a fun person at a party or in any conversation. And I like children and the poetry. And this is why I work in libraries and I don't even have to buy Langston Hughes' material because whoever's been there before has. There's one book, however, I may not buy because I'm doing a library, and I just noticed that one of the books that they want me to buy for them is called The Negro and Poetry. And that's a word we don't use, and yet I got to look at a different set. It may be a better set, and because there are kids in the school, and a lot of them are African, and some of them are from South America. And the word, you know, the language that you use for people is very important. One of the people who was teaching for me had a relationship with a minister called Mellish in Brooklyn. And the Mellishes were considered quite liberal left. But he asked me if I'd like to go. And I said, of course. And I met him at the church in Brooklyn. He was a very formal, and his wife I liked better because his wife was very warm, always solicitous of him, and she had written a book called The Slave Who Freed Haiti. You don't know that one yet, do you? Well, that's Toussaint Louverture, and I won't give you the lecture on that because that takes us off. But Toussaint was the black guy who tried to form an army with others to kick the French out of Haiti. Now, you know what Haiti is like. And Haiti is as sad now as it was then. But Toussaint is a very famous black would-be liberator. And she was a very good writer. More fictional, quasi-fiction, but he was very, very formal, very proud, handsome, very wary, would speak unless spoken to. If he liked the audience, he would speak for a long time. But if he didn't, now remember, I'm meeting him in 57, 58, something like that, and we know that he's leaving the country. I wish he had.
The second audio comes from WJYN LP 98.5, Uptown Entertainment and Development, from the Talk to Reeves show. The host, E. Marie Lambert, interviews Andrea Lawrell Sanders about the school program Parents as Leaders, where she conducted parent workshops.
Andrea, that's how you pronounce your name, Andrea Lawrell Sanders. Miss Lawrell Sanders, one, I just want to thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest and allowing us to get to know a little more about you.
I knew very little about the school district where my children were. And so, you know, I would go to the meetings and they would shoot up the acronyms that I didn't understand. I would go to the parent teachers meetings, at the school, and nobody would talk to me while I was in the room. And I was getting frustrated and ready to walk away like the average parent would when a flyer came in the door talking about, into my child's school book bag, about a program called Parents as Leaders that was being run through the United Way, and it had begun in Connecticut. And so I decided to take the program because I was like, I needed to learn. And it was life-changing. It was 6 months long. We learned everything about how school systems work from the very basic level all the way up to the federal level. We learned how to write letters. We learned how to be advocates. Mm-hmm. We learned how the money is spent in the school districts. We learned how the lunch program is operated. We learned about how the life and cycle of a child. We learned how to practice intellect over motion, judgment over evaluation, all of those life skills that is not just for parenting, but for life in general. And as I went through that program, mm-hmm. this changed my life, right? Because I was going to be an English professor.
So you said that the program was so empowering and inspiring. Mm-hmm. But I love that you were able to empower yourself and then support parents into going and speaking up for themselves and for their children. And how empowering was that for you?
Incredibly. So I was hired by the organization that ran the program, and after a year of working with them, they decided that they didn't have enough interest in it. They decided they were going to shut the program down, and I asked them for permission to continue using the program. They gave it to me. I cut it down from 6 months to 12 weeks and began shopping it at school districts. And so when I was at the University of Pennsylvania running my workshops for free with Dr. Jarvis, because the first 2 years I ran them for free, the school districts were so enamored, they began hiring me to work with their families. And I'm telling you, I walked into districts where only 5 parents were involved. And when I rolled out 3 years later, hundreds, and they stayed involved. And that is how amazing. I ended up on the flight with the F-16, with the United States Air Force Thunderbirds. It was one of those parents who was in my class in New Jersey, and she worked for the Air National Guard, and she knew that one of the things on my bucket list was breaking the sound barrier in an F-16. And they called me and told me. And, you know, one of the things amazing. The pilot said to me while we were up there, one of the things the pilot said to me while we were up there doing all our rotations, he said, you know, everything they said about you on paper is who you are on your social media pages. We saw that and we appreciated that about you, that you really loved parents, you really loved young people, and you were, what we saw was what we got. This wasn't just somebody just trying to get us to give you a... You know, it's stuff like that, when I tell people all the time, stay in your most authentic space, even if it makes you feel uncomfortable and even if it makes others feel uncomfortable, right? Because wherever you stay in your most authentic space, your tribe will find you. And that's how I've always lived my life.
We were talking about the things that feed your spirit, that make you who you are, that make you so beloved mm-hmm. on and off of social media. So we talked about your advocating and teaching parents to advocate for their students. So share something else with us.
I cry. I cry without reservation. I don't hide when I am not feeling good. I find it counterintuitive to put on airs. So if something is bothering me or I don't feel good in certain spaces, I love young people unapologetically. I talk about them all the time, all the time. That's they are very important. And I love my brothers and sisters. I love my Black people. I can about us from our different cultures and who we are, and find ways to pull us together, weave us in together so we can appreciate each other more. And I love teaching what I know, right? I don't like keeping anything that I know to myself. I believe that if we share it in the village, then the village will learn and the village will continue to share with each other. So, I mean, those are some, it's weird because I don't usually talk about myself like this. So it's hard to talk about myself in this way, about these different things.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. For other women, what would you mm-hmm. say to them if they are struggling with breaking through the fear or feeling inhibited?
I would say to them, get a book, a journal, and write in that journal. In the hardest parts of my life, when things did not feel right to me, I would write. I would write and write and write. And I would say, okay, this is what's happening. This was my response to it. What can I change? What can I change? What can I do in the next 10 minutes? What can I do in the next 10 years? And so I would tell women, when you're going through and feeling that the fear in your life, you know, you have to go through it, right? So it's either to go through it so you can get on the other side, or go through it so you can understand what it is, so that you realize that it's not something you should have been afraid of to begin with. But the worst thing we can do is do nothing at all. And so that's how I go through it. I never tell anyone that I don't feel fear, because I feel fear all the time. What I also mm-hmm. tell myself is I was born with Nanny of the Maroons on one side, Harriet Tubman on the other side, and Christ all over me. And mm-hmm. so fear no man, really, literally, right? Because I always say, when it's my time to go, it's my time to go. And while I am here, I'm going to love on the people the way the divine, the way God has ordained me to love on people, right? And so it doesn't always look the way we expect it to. But that's who I am. That's who I've always been. I tell you, I was about 35 when my parents, actually when I got out, not 35, I was in my 40s, when I got out of that airplane and called my parents and told them that I was just in an F-16 fighter jet. And they told me to get on a plane to come see them. And my father said, you know, the entire time you were growing up, we tried to change you, because we kept saying, you're a girl. There are things, certain things you can't do. You're too outspoken. Something's going to happen to you. And what they mm-hmm. recognized was, this is who I am. This is my DNA. And then my father began explaining to me that I was very much like his mother. My father's mother died when he was 11 years old. And according to the family and to my father, I look so much like her. And so the advice that I'm going to have for women is, if you want to do something, instead of talking yourself out of it by the different things you think will go wrong why you can't do it, tell yourself all the things that could go right, and start taking the steps towards it.
I hope that those of you that are listening, that you really take that in. We have to stop thinking about all the things that could go wrong.
So someone is asking this question. If one cannot express themselves through writing, what other avenues are there one able to express themselves? Can I answer that? There are times when, you know, it came down to a moan or a groan, right? I would take long walks. I would appreciate what was going on around me. I became grateful for the smallest of things, right? So I was grateful to take a deep breath. I was grateful to be able to open my eyes and see. I was grateful that my body parts were working. And I also expressed myself through music. So when I couldn't write about what I was thinking or feeling, I would find songs that spoke to what I was going through to give me the courage to kind of find where I wanted to start writing again, right? It can happen in a myriad of different ways. Some people express themselves through helping others, right? Finding what works for them in giving back to other people. I mean, there are different ways. I'm just, if you watch any leadership, Oprah, anybody that talks to you, they always say, journaling your journey. If you start to write out the things that you're going through in the moment, 6-7 years from now, when you go back in the thing, you go, woo, was I really going through that? Did I really say that? Did I really do craziness? Oh, Lord Jesus, thank God for the growth, you know? But if you don't write it out, our brains tend to forget as we get older. I'm a middle-aged woman now. And so I don't always remember everything, you know? So writing it out, I have crates and crates of books from just writing different things that I was going through. I was like, oh my God, did I really like him like that? Oh Lord, what was I thinking kind of thing, you know? But if you don't write the stuff out, you don't know where you made the missteps and where you should not go back.
That's amazing. And that is such good advice. So if you can't write it out, dance it out, walk it out, pray it out, listen to music it out, I think that's so important. So I just want to add that your writing doesn't always have to be public or for public consumption. So you can write it any way and with whatever grammar that you use, whatever language, vernacular that you use, because it's not necessarily for everybody to read or see. It's the only person that needs to be able to understand it is you. I want to talk about two more things. One, I want to talk about your cooking show, because at some point I'm gonna try to cook with you, right? Because I love food. I love eating, right? So we have that in common. And then I want to talk about Mr. Just a little bit about Mr. because I think that your relationship is so beautiful and the way that you share and write about it. Just a little, whatever you want to share about that.
Cooking for me is incredibly therapeutic, and so it's always been the thing that I've always done. I cook very well. I mean, I can't even tell a lie. My food will make you haul off and slap the hell out of somebody. And so, truly. And so when COVID-19 hit, all my friends, I would have Sunday dinner at my house. My husband and I would host a Sunday dinner every Sunday, cost people anything. We would invite certain people to come. They would show up. The only thing they had to do was bring a dessert, bring their conversation, and help to clean up the kitchen. That was it. I chose the meats every week, decided what the menu was going to be. And so when COVID-19 happened, just before COVID-19 happened, I got a call from the Philadelphia Inquirer, who said that they heard that I made the best oxtails in Philadelphia. I said, well, they did not lie. And so they sent a reporter to my house and a photographer. Pictures of my oxtails, and they wrote up this whole piece about my oxtails, and then I gave them the entire recipe for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Shortly thereafter, the WHYY asked the same thing, so I gave them the recipe, the entire recipe, how to get the meat, wash the meat, season the meat, cook the meat, all of it. And then something weird happened. COVID came around, and people kept saying, well, we don't want the recipe. You gotta teach us. I said, oh, hell no. You want me to teach you too? And so they said, yes. And that's how Bubba started, right? And teach them how to make these Jamaican meals. It's what I have found is that every time I teach a class, I keep hearing from people who say that the class, they continue to cook the food. They continue to make the soup. They continue to make the, you know, whatever it is that I had taught them how to cook. And so for me, it was not only giving them a piece of my culture, but teaching them how to do it in the most authentic way so that they never have to worry about going to a Jamaican store and having something that tasted like crazy, right? Like Jamaicans, let me tell you the secret to Jamaican food. Season your food a week in advance.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Matt Berg. I'm the station manager at WRGU-LP 92.9 FM in Germantown. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.